Did you take anything with your breakfast this morning, a vitamin pill or a regular medication? Everything much about where those came from? I mean, a manufacturing plant, sure, but way before that, something from nature came into the hands of a human being who thought, this might do some good. Our guest this hour thinks in terms of molecules of nature. That's the title of the book by Paul Torrence. The full title is Molecules of Nature, Biodiversity, the Sixth Mass Extinction, and the Future of Medicine. It's also the title of his lecture at the Science Building at Southern Oregon University this Friday, April 20th at 3:30 at the Science Building Auditorium. Paul Torrence is a chemist and emeritus professor of chemistry and biochemistry at Northern Arizona University. He arrived at NAU after a 30-year career as a research chemist at the National Institutes of Health in the Washington, D.C. area. He used to live right among us in Williams, Oregon, but is now living in Southern New York, so I'm glad to have him back in the region. Paul Torrence, welcome to the studio.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
Your research, particularly at NIH, has focused on several medical issues. Give us a brief introduction to that work.
Yes, well, it was what you might call blue sky research. It was research that was not specifically focused on one disease, but it was involving looking at a natural mechanism of defense against disease, the interferon system, which maybe people have heard about. Interferon is a molecule that can protect you against virus diseases. It also is used in the treatment of cancer today. And we were interested in understanding how it did what it does for you, and could we learn from it and capitalize on it, how we could develop some kind of a medication from what nature says about how interferon protects us.
So there's still a bunch of mysteries, it sounds like, in the human body, quite a few.
Oh, there are a boatload, but the amount of progress that's being made in the last couple of decades after the genome project and the understanding of the human genome, as well as the genome of animals and plants, is moving us forward almost at astronomical speeds.
You give a description in the book. I mean, your descriptions of walking in nature, because it sounds like you were an inveterate hiker back in the day. Your description of Antarctica in particular is appropriately stark. And you say that landscape screams a message at us. What is that message?
That message is that the world that we know is not something that's necessarily going to be there for our future generations, that Antarctica was once, that continent was once in tropical regions, and it migrated southward and eventually got colder and colder and shut off ocean currents, which then turned it into a deep freeze. But if you go below the ice, 2 miles down through the ice at Antarctica, there are fossils from those ancient times. Even now, the ice that's melting at the edges of Antarctica could change things dramatically if one of the ice shelves on the surface of Antarctica should slip off. It could change the dynamics of current movement and sea levels, many things. So we sort of live on an edge.
All right, so we have to be careful about what we do with the climate of the Earth.
We sure do. Mm-hmm.
So it seems like we probably walk around thinking that medicines come from big vats at drug companies, which I guess in the immediate past they did, but you trace this a lot farther back to these molecules of nature. I mean, at some point somebody had to say, I wonder if this would work for this.
Yeah, I think the critical thing is there was some work done by two NIH researchers, Newman and Craig, published a series of papers over the last decade or so and found that 50% of the drugs that we use through prescriptions, and this is, say, FDA-approved drugs, 50% of them have an origin in nature. And when you come to cancer drugs, that percentage goes up to 60 to 70%. So nature either gave us the medicine directly, it gave us something which we tinkered with and modified, or it gave us the blueprint. So enormous contribution from the natural world.
Would you say an even higher percentage of cancer drugs? What kinds of? Give us an example of one of the cancer
drugs.
Well,
a really classical example, and people in this area should recognize, is Taxol. Is one really good example.
From the Pacific yew tree.
That's right. And we could go to One of the ones that I like to talk about is the rosy periwinkle, known as the Madagascar periwinkle, which gave us a compound called vincristine. That's isolated from that plant, and it still is actually isolated from that plant today. And that provided a revolutionary treatment for childhood acute lymphocytic leukemia, which, say, in 1960, was a universally fatal disease. Now it is not. It can be treated, and the remission rate is well over 90%.
Really, that good?
Yeah, it was a revolution at that time. Now, there are still other examples of those kind of natural medications. There is, for instance, a lot of excitement about the so-called targeted drugs. For instance, there's one called Gleevec or Amitentab that is useful against chronic myelogenous leukemia. There's a long story there, but chronic myelogenous leukemia is a disease that starts off slow, accelerates, and then goes into what they call blast crisis, where just overwhelms the patient with massive amounts of white blood cells. And now there is this Gleevec that can be used almost like you can live with chronic myelogenous leukemia now for a very, very, very long time by just taking the Gleevec every day.
Wow.
So that cancer has been transformed from a killer into simply like a chronic disease like high blood pressure.
All right, so a lot of progress. We have to take a short break here. We're talking to Paul Torrence about his book, Molecules of Nature, back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Paul Torrence, who's a chemist, a former chemistry professor, worked at the National Institutes of Health for 30 years or so, knows a lot about all those things from nature that can be used to help human beings. He's written a book called Molecules of Nature, Biodiversity, the Sixth Mass Extinction, and the Future of Medicine. So, yes, there are some concerns expressed in the book about the wave of extinctions that appears to be going on around the planet right now and what that could do to things that we depend upon for health, life, livelihood. And he'll give a lecture by that same title at the Science Building at Southern Oregon University this Friday, April 20th at 3:30 in the auditorium. And you can join us now on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Paul, I noticed the book is not blossoms or leaves or stems of nature, but molecules of nature. I mean, so that you're really getting right down to the root of it all, aren't you?
You bet. Mm-hmm. The reason I use that title is that, nature is very diverse and has many different species, but those species all produce original molecules that are produced nowhere else. And and that's where we get so many of our medicines from. In order to have continued access to that treasury of potential advances for human beings, we need to keep the species that are producing them. And so biodiversity really translates into the most practical kind of idea of the diversity of molecules you can select to create medicines.
You are sensitive, you point out in the book, to the charge that conservationists like molecules more than people.
Oh, well, we like molecules, we like species, but I think conservation is all about people. Conservation really has people as its primary interest. Without people, there would be no conservation, no interest in it. Conservation is about sustaining the future of humanity, actually.
So when we look at the world around us and all the places that we can obtain these molecules that can help us, I mean, do you think we have barely scratched the surface of knowledge about what's available to us?
We have, in many different ways. For instance, the oceans have hardly been scratch wouldn't be the right word, but but it's only been in the past few decades we've been able to actually get to the depths of the ocean, so to speak, and we're finding remarkably fascinating chemicals within strange organisms in the ocean. There is one strange one called, of all things, Buglia maritima. It's a small organism about a millimeter in size. It exists as colonies, so it actually, when it gets thousands and thousands together, it will actually be maybe 10, 15 inches tall. And it's what's called a bryozoa. It's a whole phylum, just like vertebrates are. And there's a chemical, strangely enough, called bryostatin 1. Bryostatin 1 was originally thought to be a potential cancer drug. It went through a number of clinical trials and had been disappointing. But meanwhile, people also looked at it with respect to other diseases. And one of those they've looked at is Alzheimer's. Bryostatin has been through phase one clinical trials for its ability to reestablish neural junctions, the things that allow neurons to talk to one another. And that's one of the things that goes away in Alzheimer's disease. In addition to the plaque and the tangles, there's a disintegration of these synapses. Bryostatin's able to tell a nerve cell to reestablish these kinds of connections. The same as occurs with HIV. HIV we can treat with drug therapy, but it never goes away. It resides in a patient's cell for as long as they live. And if you stop taking the drugs like AZT, it will come right back. So now there's an idea. It's called kick and kill. Kick and kill is to get the cells that are hiding the virus to let the virus go, and then we use something else to kill the virus when it comes out. So the idea that you'd be able to get rid of the reservoir of the virus and the patient wouldn't have to take these drugs for the rest of their lives. And then even another advance was just recently reported about multiple sclerosis, and bryostatin 1 was used in a mouse model of multiple sclerosis, and again suggests that we need to move forward in investigations. So there's a drug, something that started out as a potential cancer drug and has branched out into many different areas.
Paul Torrence is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a chemist by trade. His book is called Molecules of Nature, Biodiversity, the Sixth Mass Extinction, and the Future of Medicine. I found myself wondering as I read further into the book about the ways in which we have obtained so many things from nature, and yet there's a certain disconnection between people and the way they think about nature, particularly about, you know, where their stuff comes from. I have to wonder if you snicker a little bit when people scoff at things like herbal remedies and traditional medicine.
Traditional medicine has actually helped out modern drug discovery in a number of ways. And everything I deal with is about things that have been okayed by places like FDA, but traditional medicine, for instance, the case of the leukemia, acute lymphocytic childhood leukemia, that idea came from traditional medicine, but not for cancer. Traditional medicine said that the rosy periwinkle was great for treating sugar or diabetes, although at that time people didn't know what diabetes was. When investigators actually looked at it, they didn't find any evidence for it controlling blood sugar in mouse models, but it depressed white blood cell counts. And that's where, at that time, they got the idea, maybe we could use it to treat leukemia. That's also true for a number of other drugs. There is a really awesome example, if you excuse the word, that the Nature got the 2015 Nobel Prize in a real way, the Nobel Prize for Medicine and Physiology. Artemisia and the drug artemisinin is a drug to treat malaria, which is an incredible burden in much of the world. Half of the world's population is susceptible to malaria.
And, of course, as the tropics expand with changes in climate, that could be more of the world's population.
It's going to move north and south. So the Chinese, during the Cultural Revolution, they wanted to help out. This is a strange story, but they wanted to help out Ho Chi Minh in North Vietnam because he was losing a lot of soldiers to malaria, as were we. And it became a project of the Cultural Revolution and the Red Chinese Army to develop a cure for malaria. Well, it turns out they did. And the woman that did it was named Yu Yu Tu. She shared the Nobel Prize in 2015. And she did so by going back to ancient manuscripts, 2,000 or more years old, pouring through thousands of these remedies and recipes for fevers. I mean, they didn't know malaria from, but fevers. And she screened a number of these. She tried them out, and she finally found one, Artemisia, a plant. And from that, the drug has now come to us, artemisinin, which is now considered to be the number one drug for the treatment of malaria.
I was just noticing we're talking 97 countries that have ongoing malaria transmission and 3.4 billion people at risk of malaria. It's basically almost half the world's population.
Mm-hmm.
That is an amazing number. We're again talking to Paul Torrence about his book, Molecules of Nature, Biodiversity, the Sixth Mass Extinction, and the Future of Medicine. He'll be giving a lecture by that same title on this Friday, 4:20 at 3:30 at the Science Auditorium at the Science Building at Southern Oregon University. You can join the conversation now on the Exchange. Got questions about things that we get from nature and whether they're at risk or not? 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We've talked a couple of times about the periwinkle, which is also identified as the Madagascar periwinkle. How far back does the medicinal use of that go?
Oh, that goes back probably to before anything was ever recorded. This French, certainly, they took it from the Madagascar, the Malagasy people, and brought it back to Paris in 1799 or so. And from there, it spread around the world. It went to all the tropical areas. And you can even grow it here as a kind of an annual bedding plant. It's a tropical, so it's not freeze hardy, but it goes back to before anything was ever recorded. It's sort of like that's the case for the opium poppy, and which produces morphine, and a number of other drugs. I would just like to add one other thing. For the 2015 Nobel Prize, there were two other people that won it that year. One was by the name of Satoshi Imura, and the other was William Campbell. Or Mora worked in Japan, and Campbell worked for Merck in the United States. And together, they came up with a drug called ivermectin. If you've ever treated your dog for heartworm, HeartGuard active ingredient is ivermectin. But they also realized that this drug, which originally was a veterinary product, could be used for humans. And what it's done is revolutionized things to a very large extent in many parts of the world by getting under control, in fact, even getting to the point of wiping out something called river blindness, which is a horrendous disease that is transmitted by black fly bites. The larvae penetrate to the skin and cause incredible itching, but they also go to the eyes and they cause blindness. And another disease called elephantiasis or lymphatic filariasis is a crippling disease that affects, about a billion people are at risk for that disease. And there are, last year that I have any numbers for, there were 38 million people who had this disease, and it's crippling. It blocks the lymph ducts, so your extremities, especially your legs, swell up to enormous proportions. You can't walk, and basically takes you out of circulation as a productive member of society and puts an enormous burden on the family and community.
I remember reading about elephantiasis in high school, filaria worms.
Sure.
Block the,
Yeah,
It's always a search for what can defeat the thing that is defeating part of your body.
Exactly right.
And imagine as a chemist, this is an incredibly difficult process because you're trying to find something that is toxic to an organism that you don't want in your body, and yet at the same time is not going to be toxic to you to the point of killing you as well.
Yeah, and it's you need to have some luck as well as as well as scientific skill and access to these organisms, these plants and animals. It's the odds are of any one person coming up with a useful drug is pretty low, but when you put all the knowledge together and all the resources that we have, eventually we can get there.
So when big pharma makes drugs through synthetic means, the big vats of chemicals, all that stuff, I mean, are drug makers mimicking nature? Are they improving upon it, do you think?
Well, it's both. So in some cases, they actually will clone out the gene that creates, they're actually a set of genes that create any given drug. They will clone it, put it into a bacteria or a yeast and make it in huge vats, bioreactors. Sometimes they actually pay a contract to somebody to grow a plant. That's the case for the Madagascar periwinkle, for instance. Taxol is a good example. Taxol, back in the late 80s, early 90s, was getting to be a real problem. It showed incredibly good results in certain kinds of cancer, breast and ovarian and cervical, but there was a supply problem. And the supply problem was so pernicious. Well, it would require cutting down hundreds of thousands of Taxus yew, the Pacific yew tree, in order to get enough to treat women for just 1 year. The tree would eventually become extinct. And fortunately, a scientist in France discovered that the English yew has a compound in it and that in one or two chemical steps can be converted into Taxol. And that really put everything together.
That seemed to have. I remember covering stories about the Pacific yew and the big dust up over it because it had some great healing properties. But then there were people saying we don't want them all cut down. I mean, this is the Pacific Northwest. We had to have some trees standing. But it seemed like almost overnight that discovery was made, and then that was the end of it. Nobody needed to cut down Pacific yews at all.
That's right. And that particular discovery eventually went to a bioreactor. They were able to actually plant tissue culture, grow the plant cells in a huge vat and isolate the precursor to Taxol from that.
I remain amazed at the fact that we have managed to figure out therapeutic properties without killing all the patients over the years.
Well, there's a very tight screening of anything that goes to the clinic. By the time it gets to the point where it's being tried in a human through an investigational new drug permit through the FDA, it's been through a tremendous amount of in vitro tissue culture kinds of work and a massive amount of in vivo work with animal models. People are very careful about what go into people. It's actually in the people eventually that volunteer for clinical trials are in many ways as important as a scientist because they're the ones that make possible the learning that we know how to go to the next step to make things better for the next patient.
People are willing to take some risks on their own bodies to
exactly
move
right
things forward. We have about a minute to a break, and I want to ask about Mayapple because this is something that you saw on walks with your father many years ago in Western Pennsylvania.
Surely. I grew up in the very industrialized area, very small areas that were available anything you could call wild. And my dad used to take me to a local cemetery where that had become a pauper cemetery, where the mayapple was doing very well, thank you very much. And it's from the mayapple. Again, it was a remedy, a folk remedy, and it's extremely poisonous. But chemists were able to find out that what that poisonous substance was and tinker with it and turn it into a cancer drug. So the lowly mayapple, and it's sort of remarkable. Part of the reason the mayapple can keep going is that there is a terrapin called the eastern box turtle that eats the fruit of the mayapple and is responsible for spreading the mayapple to keep its stands of mayapple coming on.
Go Eastern Box Turtle. Another great story from the book Molecules of Nature by Paul Torrance. He'll give a lecture about the molecules of nature on Friday at Southern Oregon University. We'll come back and talk more with him, and you can join us by phone or email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about items in the natural world that we have been able to turn to benefit. I mean, not just the things we eat, but the things that can heal us from various diseases and injuries. Paul Torrance has taken great note of this in many years of work as a chemist. He's a former professor of chemistry and biochemistry at Northern Arizona University. But before that, he spent 30 years as a research chemist at the National Institutes of Health in the Washington, D.C. area. He's written a book called Molecules of Nature, Biodiversity, the Sixth Mass Extinction, and the Future of Medicine. He'll give a lecture by that name Friday at 3:30 at the Science Auditorium at Southern Oregon University. And he's here now in the studio, back in the region. He used to live in the Williams area, now living in Southern New York. You can join us on the exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to turn away from people for a moment and turn to cows to ask you specifically about sweet clover disease.
Oh.
And what goes on there?
Oh, this was a real mystery for the farmers of the Midwest at one time. The cattle just started having a terrible disease in which they would bleed to death internally. And everybody figured, well, they just really had no idea what it was. And so finally it was discovered that there is a particular in clover and hay, when it kind of cures in a particular way, it's too wet, you can get the growth of an organism that produces a substance that stops blood from clotting. And originally that was developed into something that we all have heard of, probably warfarin, rat mm-hmm. poison.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But warfarin is a chemical which has now also been translated into the human clinic. It's used to control blood clotting in case of people, for instance, that have an arrhythmia of certain kinds, where blood clots could form in the heart and go to the brain, or other kinds of diseases in the arteries that can lead to blood clots. And so I think there are a substantial number of people on that kind of therapy now that owe the success of that therapy, prevention of blood clots, prevention of stroke, prevention of heart attacks, to warfarin.
You know, the story of the sweet clover disease in cows, though, made me think of white snake root and the fact that this is something that cows can and do eat. It, you know, I think it gives them a bit of an upset stomach or stomachs. But it's what killed Abraham Lincoln's mother, for example, because she drank milk from a cow that had ingested white snake root. And I just wonder how much of the work of chemists like yourself over the years has been trying to figure out these mysteries where why did it not kill the cow, but it killed the person who ate stuff from the cow?
Yeah, well, that's certainly one thing that you'd want to look at. I mean, I was going to say, maybe I have to try your white snake root. I hadn't heard that story. So
really?
Thank you so very much.
Sure. Yeah, Nancy Hanks.
If we get a new drug, I'll definitely share the patent with you.
grab the headphones. We have a call for you from Jason in Trail. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about molecules of nature with Dr. Paul Torrence. Welcome, Jason.
Hi. Thanks for taking it. I grew up in the Western Pacific, and there are many, many species of cone shells out there, some of which can kill you pretty quickly. And I was wondering if anybody has gotten any use out of any of those toxins.
That's a good question. Thanks for that, Jason.
Yeah, Jason, you're spot on there. You probably need to start your own research institute because, cone shells are have provided one specific new medicine now. It's called Prialt. It's used to treat intractable pain, that is, pain that cannot be managed in any other way, like the pain of cancer after you become tolerant to morphine, for instance. And this Prialt is from the venom of a cone snail, and it's not addicting. So that's the first of many drugs that are going to come from the cone snail. The cone snail, there are 800 species. It produces many, 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 many molecules, an incredible, almost a constellation, a universe of molecules. And they're under investigation not only for non-addictive pain relief, but also for the control of diabetes. So venoms in general are a huge area.
Even snake venom.
One of the most prescribed drugs in the United States, it's on the top three, I think, is lisinopril for the control of blood pressure. That comes from a viper from the Brazilian Amazon, a thing called the Fertilance, one of the deadliest snakes on Earth. And what chemists did there was take the venom apart, look and see what parts of it were the things that caused an observed drop in blood pressure of its victims. Then they made this outside the organism. They actually created the molecule synthetically, and then they played with it, tinkered with it, until they produced molecules like lisinopril.
Your discussion of blood pressure reminds me of a passage in your book that it carried information I had never seen before from history about Franklin Delano Roosevelt and how high his blood pressure got during the course of his presidency. And in fact, the top number, I think you said, was recorded over 300 not long before he died.
Yes, and the only drug then they had for any kind of control of blood pressure was something called reserpine, which was a natural product, but it was too toxic to be taken to control blood pressure. And I often have wondered how history would have changed if Roosevelt had been on lisinopril, for instance.
In better health, certainly, in the latter days of his life.
Right.
Yeah, I have to wonder, aside from the contents of the book, what you make of how drug companies act now in the marketplace and the constant barrage of television commercials aimed at older viewers, for example. You know, ask your doctor if Widatsol is right for you, that sort of thing.
Oh, well, I'm stuttering here because it's hard to take it all in one swoop. I'm circumspect, certainly, and feel that that's definitely sort of an ethical breach to be trying to preach the virtues of a drug to people that don't have an understanding of the disease and the complexities of treating a disease. It's not so simple as they say, and they don't, even though they have all this verbiage in the advertisements with details about the drug, that doesn't really even begin to cover the considerations that should go into it.
Yeah, when they list the side effects, it's downright scary, you know. In some cases, could lead to death. It's, why? Ask my doctor if this is right for me. I have to ask about antibiotics, and you do cover this in the book a bit, because some things that I'd never heard about before, like that Alexander Fleming, when he saw the penicillin sitting there, didn't think much of it and didn't think it could be produced, and so he kind of left that work to other people. But as you look at the world now and the fact that we have all these strains of bacteria that are developing resistance or tolerance to antibiotics, I mean, are you concerned about the future of their use?
Well, yes, I'm concerned, like any person in medicine would be, that the drug companies are going to be able to keep up with the changing nature of bacteria and infectious diseases. I have great optimism in that regard, because we have found out so much about the DNA of bacteria, of the genomes, and we now know, for instance, that Streptomyces, which produce many of the most useful antibiotics that humans have ever had, like beginning with streptomycin and on and on. Streptomycin is the bacteria that we've investigated has a whole number of cryptic, secret, hidden sequences in its DNA that could be used to make untold numbers of antibiotics. It only uses a couple of the sequences to manufacture things like streptomycin, and that's true for many other bacteria also. So it's called genome mining. Mm-hmm. Genome mining to find the cryptic sequences that spell out something that we can't get our hands on. It might have been there in the evolutionary past of the bacteria, but because we can understand the genomics, we can also now express that gene.
There's a passage in the book where you kind of give the yin and yang, though, of working at the genetic level, because you talk about the uses of recombinant DNA and its usefulness in making new medicines, but then you also recount your experiences as a farmer in Josephine County dealing with the GMO crops and the feelings about those.
And I think, that's a question that's directly relevant to the whole drug discovery idea. I mean, for instance, you know, the monarch butterfly requires milkweed in order in its life cycle. The young larvae eat the milkweed. They take in large amounts of things called cardiac glycosides, which are poisonous to predators, and that's how the monarch kind of maintains itself. It's a diet of milkweed in the young. And now with GMO corn, Roundup Ready corn, Roundup Ready soybeans in the Midwest, there is no more milkweed. And the monarch populations are dropping, are in fact pretty much endangered. And so as we simplify the natural world more and more with all our attempts to maximize production, we are simplifying it at our own peril, wiping out organisms and life cycles that we don't really understand, but yet could still benefit us greatly.
And you ask the question in the book, as you focus on the sixth great extinction underway now, do we know what we are losing? And the answer appears to be yes, and we don't care. Or am I oversimplifying what your perception might be?
Well, sort of one hope that some of us have, and my purpose in writing the book, is to inform people about some of the things that nature does for us. The hope would be that when people understand how vital nature has been to our own health, not even to mention the future generations, our children and our grandchildren, maybe we will take a different attitude toward nature. And that's not the only service, of course, that nature provides for us. There are many, like clean water and clean air and good soils and just a host of things that we don't exist without. There's a moral behind all this, too, a moral justification. This natural world has produced us through an evolutionary process, and so we are now stewards of all of that, and it's incumbent upon us to take better care of it.
Well, then that gets us to the final point here, which is, I mean, what do we do? And I'll combine this with a question that Jamie in Medford dropped off a while ago about the idea of a Noah's Ark of seeds. You know, how we preserve certain species of seeds in the event of a mass extinction. I know from reading this is actually underway in some places already.
Yeah, I mean, there is one group of scientists that think that we're not going to be able to stop the tidal wave that's occurring, and we need to preserve as many of these species by whatever means we can. So certainly seed production, preservation of their genes and liquid nitrogen and so on is one way to go about it. The rest of us feel that we need to preserve as much of the natural environment as we can, that maybe to keep as many species alive as we can, that maybe in the future people will see really what's going on, and there'll be an opportunity to repopulate the earth with the species from that kind of arc.
Do you think there's enough concern to hold off climate change from being hugely disruptive, or that we can stop the sixth mass extinction?
Well, climate change is an important consideration, but it's secondary to the consideration of habitat preservation. There will be no species unless they have homes. There will be no homes unless they have habitat.
All right. The book is called Molecules of Nature, Biodiversity, the Sixth Mass Extinction, and the Future of Medicine. It's by Paul Torrance. He'll give a lecture with the same title at the Science Building at Southern Oregon University this Friday, April 20th at 3:30 in the afternoon. Public is welcome. It is free. Paul Torrance, pleasure to meet you. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.